Hello, this is Mrs. Arsenault, and today I'm going to be reading Part 3, Chapter 2. It was a warm, sultry morning. The pink road wound through the desert-like country, and quite suddenly, in the middle of nowhere, it divided. One way went northwest, the other northeast. Signposts at the junction pointed both ways, and each sign read, "To the Palace." "Here's a dilemma," said the professor. "Which way shall we go?" "Watch your step," squawked the Wiffle Bird. The professor looked at her closely. "You couldn't possibly explain that remark, could you?" he asked. She remained silent. "There's only one thing to do," the professor declared. "We must take a gamble. Come along." They took the road heading northwest. Having traveled for some time, they turned a corner, and there, sitting in the middle of the road, was a creature. He was staring at his very tiny toes and singing a sad, mournful song. He had a small head and a large body. In fact, he was completely pear-shaped. He was the color of early morning mist and had two soulful brown eyes with extremely long, silky eyelashes and a topknot of hair that stuck out of his head like the bristles of a scrubbing brush. The professor pulled the children to a halt. The creature obviously had not seen them, for he continued to sing and stare at the ground. "Oh, woe, woe is me. I'm fat and my toes are so tiny. Hi, diddly, dum, de, din. I wish I knew what place I'm in. Ho, oh, alas, alack, hooray. I'm here tomorrow, gone today." The professor cleared his throat and tapped the whatever it was on the shoulder. The creature looked up quite unsurprised and stared for a long time. Then he simply said, "Oh, hello." "Good morning," said the professor brightly. "We were wondering if you could give us some help." "Help? Oh, yes, it would be nice," the creature replied absently. "My name is Savant. May I know yours?"
"Know my what?"
"Your name."
"Ah, yes, I have a name. Somewhere." He looked around vaguely. "I think I'm Grick. Or is it a dunk? I'm sure I'm somebody. It's on a piece of paper. I don't know where I put it."
"Would it be that paper in your hand?"
"What hand?" The creature looked startled. "Oh, yes, here we are." He peered at a piece of faded parchment which he had been clutching. "Yes, this is definitely what I am. I'm an oink."
The professor was excited.
"I thought you probably were, but I wasn't sure. It's a great pleasure to meet you."
"Is it?" said the creature. "I've never met me, so I wouldn't know."
"Could you tell me if this is the correct way to the palace?"
"What palace?"
"That one up there," the professor pointed.
"Gracious, what is that?" The oink peered at the mountain.
"I don't see very much, you know, only my toes."
He looked back at the ground and began singing again. "If I had 11 toes, I would use one for a nose, which I haven't got, because it's much too hot." He looked at the professor and said, "It is too hot for a nose, isn't it?"
"Well, it certainly is warm," agreed the professor.
"Yes, indeed." The oink rolled his eyes up to the sky and rocked slowly backwards and forwards. "No doubt about it. A nose would be miserable in this heat." The children burst out laughing. The professor decided to try again. "Is this the road to the palace?"
The oink jumped. "You startled me. Who are you?"
The professor sighed. "I'm just trying to find out if this road leads anywhere."
"Ah, well, I'll tell you nothing for something," said the oink solemnly.
"If you follow this road long enough, you're definitely going to get somewhere. You haven't seen an oink by any chance, have you?"
The professor grinned.
"Funny you should ask. I was just talking to one."
"Were you?"
The oink seemed very impressed. "I haven't been in touch since I left the Wangdoodle."
"When did you last see the Wangdoodle?"
"Oh, perhaps it was yesterday."
"I came from where I was," said the oink.
"Did you take this road or the other road back there?" pressed the professor.
"Yes, definitely," nodded the oink, and he began to sing again.
"It's left or right to any place, depending on the way you face. And when you're left and looking round, then right seems much the better ground. But just when right is paradise, the left appears to be as nice." "That fellow isn't as absent-minded as he makes himself out to be," the professor confided to the children. "He can't remember anything, yet he suddenly spoke of the Wangdoodle. I'm sure that last song was meant to confuse us."
"I'll bet the proc sent him," said Ben.
"My guess exactly. Come on." The professor led the way around the oink, who continued singing to himself, apparently oblivious of everything but his toes. However, after they had gone a short distance, the professor and the children turned for a last look, and the oink was nowhere in sight.
"Ha!" said the professor. "I thought as much. He's probably gone straight to the proc."
"Oh, dear." Lindy suddenly felt anxious.
"Don't worry, Lindy. Look how content the Wifflebird is. I'm sure we're doing the right thing."
"Could I take off my scrappy cap?" she asked. "I'm feeling awfully hot."
"I should say not," the professor replied. "You must all keep your hats on. I told you how important they are."
Then he cried excitedly, "Well, look at that. No wonder you're feeling hot." The pink road ahead wound its way among a number of steaming, bubbling pools. Surrounded by the white desert, they heaved and swirled like cream in a mixer, making the most wonderful, bubbly, squelchy sounds. Suddenly, one of the pools began to rise like a cake in an oven, swelling and expanding, and finally exploding in a shower of white foam. Another pool exploded, and then another.
"We must be in a geyser basin," declared the professor.
"What's a geyser?" asked Lindy.
"Just what you see, a series of fountain-like jets coming from boiling water underground that has turned to steam." Lindy moved around to the far side of a pool just as a plume of water rose into the air.
"Oh, professor," she cried, "I can see you through the water. You look all wavy. Can you see me?"
"I can indeed," the professor peered at her through the fountain. "It's like looking through the mirrors at a funhouse, isn't it?"
Ben and Tom walked on down the road. The Wifflebird gave a squawk and flapped around the professor's head.
"Watch it," she called.
She flew to the top of the fountain and balanced on the crest, tumbling over and over on it, looking like a multicolored spinning ball.
"I am watching, my friend," the professor called out to her, "and very pretty you look, too."
The boys were a considerable way down the road. Ben said, "Look, there's another signpost. Let's see what it says." The sign read, "To the Stump."
"I've heard of that," said Tom.
"Yes, of course," cried Ben excitedly. "Don't you remember the first signpost we ever saw back in the Blandlands? The professor said then that we would have to pass the stump. Now this really proves we're on the right road."
"That must be it over there." Tom pointed to a large rock shaped like an anvil with a flat, smooth top. Beyond it was a grove of stringy-looking trees, ash gray and without foliage, standing like ghostly sentinels guarding the foothills.
Ben said, "Let's run and tell the professor."
"No, wait." There was a quality in Tom's voice that Ben had seldom heard. He followed his brother's gaze. His mouth fell open and his legs felt as though they were turning to jelly. Standing a little way from the stump, glittering and gleaming in the sunlight, were two of the most beautiful mini motorcycles the boys had ever seen. They had thick, deeply grooved tires and bold, upswept handlebars. The powerful engines were slung beneath a backbone of gleaming silver tubing, and the jet-black gas tanks had orange and red and acid pink flames painted on them. A large sign near the bikes proclaimed, "Try the Gazook 200, world's most powerful minicycle. No better way to get where you're going. Free rides for all." Ben forgot all about being the oldest and the fact that he ought to be responsible and set a good example for the other children.
"Come on," he said ecstatically. The professor, who had been hurrying to catch up with the boys, saw them running towards the mini cycles. It took only seconds for him to grasp the situation.
"No, boys, no," he yelled at the top of his voice. But one of the geysers erupted behind him, and his warning was drowned by the noise. Ben and Tom swung into the thick leather saddles and kicked the starters. The Gazooks sprang to life with a roar, crackling, growling, snarling, quivering with suppressed power. With sure instinct, the two boys opened the throttles and let out the clutches. The bikes leaped forward, spitting flames and belching clouds of exhaust that hung like an ominous black snake over the white sand. The professor came to a halt with Lindy beside him.
"Oh, fiddlesticks," he said angrily.
"What great mini bikes," said Lindy. "Ben has been wanting one for ages."
"Unfortunately, Lindy, those are not what they seem. They are Gazooks."
"What are Gazooks?" some of the most diabolical creatures in Wangdoodleland. I warned you all that the Proc would stop at nothing, that when all else failed, he would use our weaknesses for weapons. The boys' desire completely overcame their sense of caution, and they walked right into his trap. Lindy was stunned. You mean that they aren't motorbikes? They're actually creatures? I mean just that. Wow. The boys careered past her in wide sliding turns, the tires gouging out deep furrows of flying sand. What's so terrible about gazooks anyway? The boys are just taking a ride. No, they're not. What they don't know is that once you get on a gazook, you can never get off. The noise was deafening. Lindy put her hands over her ears. The boys raced back and forth across the desert, laughing and joking, mowing down the little red cactus plants, and generally causing havoc. When they finally tired of their high-speed maneuvers, they tried to slow down and discovered, to their horror, that they could not. The brakes would not respond at all. Ben's gazook turned sharply and raced towards the stump. As it came abreast of the professor, the gazook reared up, giving Ben a split second in which to yell, "I can't stop this thing!" The creature crashed down and roared off across the sand, with Ben bouncing hard in the saddle. He saw Tom heading directly towards him and swerved to avoid a collision. Tom was shouting, "What do I do, Ben? What do I do?" The wiffle bird flew into the air and screamed, "Up a gum tree!" "What does she mean?" asked Lindy. "It's an expression meaning there's no place to go," said the professor, looking very bewildered. "Is that all it means? Don't bother me, Lindy. I'm trying to figure it out." "Up a gum tree!" shrieked the wiffle bird again. She flew around and around frantically. The professor covered his face with his hands. Lindy tugged at his sleeve, but he seemed not to notice her. She tugged again. "What is it?" His voice was sharp with annoyance. "I'm sorry, Professor, but I just want to say one thing." She waited until the gazooks had roared past. "Are you sure that the wiffle bird doesn't mean something else? Perhaps it's like you told us. You know, she's saying one thing and meaning another." The professor looked at Lindy. Then he looked around and spotted the grove of weird-looking trees behind the stump. "My gosh, Lindy!" He clapped a hand to his head. "You're an angel, an absolute angel!" He ran across the sand, waving his arms and yelling to the boys as loudly as he could, "Head for the trees! Head for the trees!" Ben heard him and nodded in understanding. He could feel the creature beneath him straining to pull in a different direction. It took all his strength to keep the gazook pointing towards the trees. They crashed headlong into the grove, and a remarkable thing happened. The gazook sank into a thick, sticky-looking substance that covered the ground. Long bands of rubbery pulp became enmeshed in the spokes of the wheels, clogging and slowing them down until the bike was forced to a halt. The professor ran to the edge of the grove. "Get off, Ben! Get off now!" he yelled, and jumped neatly to one side as the gazook carrying Tom shot past him and also plunged into the mirror. The boys leapt from the thrashing, churning creatures. "Try to climb the trees!" the professor cried. Stumbling, plunging, dragging themselves along through the thick gum, muscles trembling with fatigue, the boys managed to pull themselves into a tree. The gazooks roared with frustration and lay on the ground in rage. Their wheels were jammed, their fenders dented and buckled from the crash. They lunged and struggled until they were upright once more, then shook themselves and spat and choked on a cloying gum. Slowly, laboriously, they heaved themselves out of the grove and onto dry land. With a howl of rage, they raced away towards the foothills, snarling, snapping, and belching black exhaust until they became mere specks on the horizon and finally disappeared. The professor stood gazing up at the boys. Ben saw the anger written on his face. "I'm sorry, Professor. I'm really sorry." "I should hope so. You could have been killed, or you could have broken something. Any one of us could have been run over." The professor was shaking with mingled relief and rage. "Seldom have I seen such a brilliant display of enthusiasm and daring. What a pity that you wasted it on a mere self-indulgence. How much better it would have been had you channeled all that energy and directed it towards something constructive." He sat down and put his chin on his hands and gazed moodily across the desert. Ben discovered that however he tried, he could not get down from the tree. The more he moved, the more he was trapped by the horrible sticky substance.
After a few moments, he cleared his throat and called tentatively. "Professor, I'm having a bit of a problem. I'm stuck." "I'm not surprised," the professor replied. "You're up in a gum tree."
"I am?"
"You both are." Tom asked, "How are we going to get out of this mess?" The professor did not look at them. "I can only think of one way right now, and that is to chew your way out. It'll take a while. You'd better get started."
There was a pause.
"You mean we have to chew this stuff? The whole tree?" Tom was appalled.
"Well, it's gum, isn't it? I thought all boys liked gum. If you can think of a better way down, then by all means, try it."
Benjamin reluctantly picked a piece of the bark and chewed on it. His eyes widened with surprise.
"This tastes like bubble gum. It really does. Try some, Tom."
Tom took a bite.
"It is bubble gum. It's delicious. This is going to be easy."
He took a whole sticky fistful. Lindy sat down beside the professor. Seeing him so upset made her quite tearful. She slipped her hand into his.
"I've never seen you so angry before," she said quietly.
"I've never been so angry before." Lindy thought about it for a while. Then, with her usual candor, she said,
"I don't mean to be rude or anything, but I think you're being a bit unfair."
She struggled to find the right words.
"I don't think Ben and Tom did anything so really terrible. I mean, they are boys, and boys just love machines and powerful things like motorbikes. Didn't you feel that way when you were a boy?"
The professor looked at her for a long moment. He slipped an arm around her shoulders.
"Yes, Lindy, I felt exactly that way when I was a boy, and I did many things that were foolish. But occasionally an angry, sensible adult showed me the error of my ways. Tom and Ben were foolish and irresponsible. Their actions put us all in great danger. And as a sensible adult, I think I had a perfect right to get angry and thereby teach them an important lesson." At that moment, there was a very loud report behind them, and they turned in alarm to look at the boys whose cheeks were bulging with gum.
"What was that noise?" inquired the professor sharply. Ben pointed to his brother, and with his mouth full, he mumbled, "He just blew the biggest bubble you ever saw." He was beginning to look green.
"I don't think I can chew much more," he said.
"I like bubble gum, and this stuff is great, but it's awfully sweet."
Lindy, astonished, said, "Look at Tom." He was blowing another bubble. They all watched in amazement as it grew and grew.
Tom was going cross-eyed in his effort to expand the bubble, which was already the size of his head and still growing. The wiffle bird flew into the air and flapped past the boys.
"Keep a stiff upper lip," she squawked.
The professor looked startled. Then he said, "Do exactly as she says, Tom. Keep a stiff upper lip and don't let that bubble burst, whatever you do." Tom could only wave a hand to show that he understood. He had to concentrate very hard, for the huge bubble was now bigger than he was. He felt a tugging sensation and realized that the bubble was pulling him, lifting him out of the tree. He kicked his legs as hard as he could. There was a loud, squelchy pop, and Tom suddenly floated up into the sky. Lindy, the professor, and Ben witnessed the amazing spectacle of a boy soaring through the air at the end of a giant balloon.
"Keep it up, Tom! Keep it up!" cried the professor.
Ben stopped his chewing for a moment and observed his brother with considerable respect and awe. A little way out of the grove, Tom floated gently down to earth, landing near the professor. The tremendous bubble collapsed in a sticky heap on top of him. Lindy and the professor quickly cleared it away, and the boy sat up, greatly relieved to be on firm ground once again. The professor called out,
"All right, Ben, you know what you have to do. Let's see if you can blow a bigger bubble than Tom."
Ben chewed hard and tried a number of times before he produced a bubble with any promise of success. He blew it up very, very carefully, and everyone sent up a terrific cheer as he rose out of the tree and high into the sky, up and up until he was eventually just a dot among the clouds. Then a terrible thing happened. The huge bubble exploded, and Ben tumbled towards the earth. Lindy screamed, Tom gasped, and the professor shouted, "Blow another bubble!" Ben worked frantically at the wad of gum in his mouth. It was difficult because he was rolling over and over as he fell. It was only a matter of seconds, but it seemed like an eternity before he was able to blow another bubble large enough to break his fall. He made a very bumpy landing. He looked pale and uttered strange, garbled sounds. It was apparent that he had swallowed his gum. The professor gave him a tremendous thump on the back, and Ben coughed the gum up. He drew in deep breaths of fresh air, and it was not long before his color returned to normal. "We have wasted valuable time," said the professor. "The Gazooks will certainly have used this delay to go to the proc, and that means more trouble." He tipped his head and said with gentle scorn, "It would be such a help if we could stay together from now on and work as a team. Do you think we might manage that?" The children nodded fervently. "Right, then let's get out of this miserable spot."